You're listening to the BibleChallenge.org Old Testament Studies. For more information, go to stpeterslakemary.org. Now here's the Reverend Charles Holt.
Today we're going to be covering the book of 2 Kings, and we're just going to look at the first 8 chapters and the ministry of the prophet Elisha. The book of Kings, you'll remember, was finalized sometime after the fall of both Israel and Judah, the northern and the southern kingdoms. And it's written, in a sense, to explain, why are we in exile? Why? What happened? You know, things were going so great, but why are we so troubled right now? And it explains the sins that led up to the fall of both Judah and Israel. And in writing that kind of history, it really does help keep you humble so that you don't repeat the same kind of mistakes when you get restored back into the land, and help you to understand the difficulties and problems you need to avoid in the future. As you look at the structure there on page 145, just sort of to locate where we're going to be today, we're still in that second section, the divided kingdom, where we're thinking about how the interaction between Israel and Judah. Remember the split? The northern kingdom is Israel, and that was 10 of the tribes, and then Judah remained by itself as a single tribe in the south. The way the book of 2 Kings will end, and we'll cover this next week, both the fall of the northern kingdom in Samaria, the capital city being the comes down first. It almost does in our section today. And then the fall of the southern kingdom with the sacking of Jerusalem in 587. So, in this divided kingdom, when we get to 2 Kings chapter 1, we end with a summary statement of, the book of 1 Kings ends with a summary statement of King Ahab's son, Ahaziah, who reigned over Israel in the north. And take a look at that with me. We're going to go back to 1 Kings, the very last chapter, 1 Kings chapter 22, the last couple of verses. Verse 51, it says, Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel and Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned 2 years over Israel. Now, this is very formulaic for the book of 1 and 2 Kings, and what he's trying to do is locate the different reigns of the kings in relationship to one another, both in the line of succession. Ahab was the evil king of Israel, Ahab and Jezebel. No one did anything worse than Ahab. He was really bad. And then also setting that monarchy of Uzziah in relationship to the southern kingdom, and that was currently being ruled by Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah. Now notice the formula here in verse 52. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the way of his father, and in the way of his mother, and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. He served Baal and worshipped him, and provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger in every way that his father had done. Okay, you see that? The kings, as they're often given a summary statement like this, every single king as you go through, and they're compared either to David or Jehoshaphat, and sometimes they're compared to Ahab. Ahab being the worst, if you get compared to him, that's really bad. If you walked in the ways of your father, Ahab, then that means you not only served a golden calf, which is what Jeroboam had done, but you also served the god Baal. There's evil and then there's evil. Right. There's bad and then there's really bad. Worshipping golden cows is bad. Worshipping Baal, really bad. And so we'll see as you go through the kings, they'll say things like, well, he did not walk in the ways of Ahab, but he did walk in the ways of Jeroboam. Still evil. Just not as bad. Likewise, you can also have degrees of being a good king. Walked in the ways of his father David, but, there's a little but caveat, but he did not tear down the altars in the high places. So he worshipped Yahweh. He wasn't bad in the sense of worshipping a golden cow. He did worship Yahweh, but he didn't clean up the mess of his predecessor. So you have different degrees of good and bad in the kings as in these summary statements. And you always want to look to these summary statements for clues. Next week, I'm going to give you a list of all the different kings, both in the northern and the southern, and we'll see which ones were bad and which ones were good. You'll remember that all of the northern kings were bad. There was just a matter of degree of badness. In the southern kingdom, you had 20 kings, but a portion of them were good. Yeah, it was like four that were good, several that were mixed, four that were mixed, and 12 that were bad. Okay. So 2 Kings begins, and we're talking about Ahaziah. He has an accident. He falls through the lattice in his upper chamber in Samaria, and he lays sick. And so he says, well, go inquire of Baal. And his servants go out, and who do they run into but Elijah? And Elijah, in his smart aleck prophetic way, goes, what? Is there no God in Israel that you can inquire? You have to go talk to Baal of Ekron? Go back to your master and tell him that he's going to die. And so the servants go back, and the king asks them in verse 5, why have you returned? And they say to him, well, there came a man to meet us and said to us, go back to the king who sent you and say to him, thus says the Lord, is it because there's no God in Israel that you're sending to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Therefore you shall not come down from the bed which you have gone up, and you shall surely die. And he said, the king says to these servants, who was this guy? Can you describe him for me? What kind of man was it who came to meet you and told you of these things? And they answered him, he wore a garment of hair with a belt of leather around his waist. And the king says, knew it! Elijah! The Tishbite! And he's really upset with the prophet of Yahweh, and he purposes to have him put to death. So he sends his captains with 50 men each to go and put to death Elijah. And Elijah calls down fire from heaven and consumes the captain and his 50. This happens three times that he sends out these 50 men. The first two are consumed, and the last one, Elijah shows mercy. Yahweh shows mercy. And of course, it came to pass that exactly as Elijah the prophet had spoken, this evil king was put to death in his bed. He did not recover from his accident. Verse 17, so he died according to the word of the Lord that Elijah had spoken. And Jehoram became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, because Ahaziah had no son. Now the rest of the acts of Ahaziah that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Now that book of Chronicles is not the Chronicles that we have in our Bible. That book is lost to history, or lost to the sands of time, or however you would put it. But that's a different book. The Chronicles will go back and look at these different kings, but that's not the book that's talking about. So chapter 2, we come to the problem of succession. Before we get there, I do want to have you look on the page 146 at this map. Now, during the era of the divided kingdom, you have the southern kingdom, which is in yellow there, and the northern kingdom is in blue. These are the 10 tribes and the one tribe of Judah. Now, as you're going through this section, what we begin with is a challenge from the southwest down there, the kingdom of Moab. And this will be the occasion for Elisha, the prophet, to cut his teeth and prove himself to be a worthwhile prophet of the Lord. But the main challenge that is going to come to the nation or to the northern kingdom will actually not be from the south, but from the north. It'll be from the Assyrian Empire. And this empire is going to put tremendous pressure on the northern kingdom. And Elisha holds them back as a prophet. He holds back an empire. But eventually, in his prophecy, will prophesy the demise of the northern kingdom in the judgment of Yahweh through the hands of the Assyrians. So it's important to understand some of the geography for this section and where we're going. So remember, there were three prophetic offices in the Old Testament. You know what they are? The prophet, the priest, and the king. Prophet, priest, and king. And the succession for the priestly and kingly lines is pretty self-explanatory, though it's not without problems. But it's basically by heredity. Is that right? You inherit the kingdom. Not so with the prophets. Just because you're a son of a prophet doesn't make you a prophet. Prophets pass on the mantle in a spiritual way. And so the crisis comes with Elijah. And we actually read the passage in our verses this morning in the readings where Elijah goes up to the mountain of the Lord and he thinks, I'm the only one left. I'm the only one who has not bowed the knee to Baal. And they're trying to get my life, and he is despairing and he's lamenting his life that once he's dead, there is no more Yahweh worshipers left. And the Lord takes him up, and he has a Moses moment. Takes him up into a cave, and he passes by him, just like Moses experienced in Exodus chapter 32. The Lord passes by Elijah and tells him, you're not the only one. Number one, I want you to appoint your successor in a man named Elisha. And he also gives him some other instructions of who else he is to appoint, one of them being the future king of Syria, who will one day come and judge the northern kingdom. That's kind of a difficult assignment, to appoint the one who will judge your nation. And he also tells him this, I have reserved for myself 7,000 people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So cheer up, Elijah. You're not the only one. And it's not going to die with you. The prophetic line will continue through the man Elisha. So chapter 2 is that passing of the torch, or we should say passing of the mantle, from Elijah to Elisha. And the way that this works is Elijah and Elisha are walking along a river, and Elijah puts his mantle in the water, his garment, and it parts. Now, what does that make you remember? Moses in the parting of the Red Sea, Joshua in the parting of the River Jordan. And this is very important. You should always connect the prophets with Moses. They're not kings. They're not priests, so you don't connect them with Levi and you don't connect them with David. Connect them with Moses. Moses was a prophet. You remember Moses was, and I should have looked up the verse before I came today, but Moses was told by the Lord that there would be a prophet that would be raised up like you. Moses was a prophet of the Lord, a spokesperson for God. And so this is the connection that you need to make. Moses gives the law of Moses, the Torah. The prophets are essentially God's prosecuting attorneys of that covenant document. So their role is to hold the kings and the priests and the people of Israel accountable to following the law of Moses. That's the connection to Moses. And you should always associate prophets with Moses. Yeah.
Is there a connection also with the rending of the veil of the temple at the time of Jesus' death?
What? And the
with the parting of the garments?
Yes, there is in a symbolic way, because there was this sea that was, in a sense, a barrier to the Lord, and the parting of the sea, the parting of the barrier. I'd have to think about that a little bit more, but an interesting thing to contemplate, some of the connections to the New Testament with that. But definitely the association with what Moses had done. And that's intentional. So Elijah is taken up into heaven, and this is a connection that you can make with Jesus, because he also was taken up into heaven in the same kind of way, taken up riding on the clouds. There was one other person in the Bible that was lifted up into the heavens that way. Do you remember who it was? In Genesis. Enoch. That's right. Good, Fran. Wow, that's pretty good. You win the Bible trivia challenge of today. Yeah, Enoch, that's great. So when he's being beamed up into the heavenly realms, I know I probably shouldn't make the Star Trek, but he was you know, being lifted up. What is left is his mantle, his garment. And Elisha picks that up, and he rolls it up, and he does exactly the same thing that Elijah does. He parts the river. Now, there are 50 sons of prophets there, and these guys are, in a sense, prophets in training. And they observe what happens, and they make this statement. First, they ask this question, which is the crisis of succession. Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? You know, are we doomed? But then when they see Elijah strike the water, the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho saw him opposite them, and they said, "The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha." And they came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. Now, Elisha had made a request of Elijah, that you would give me a double portion. Now, that is actually a typical request that the firstborn child would make of his father. Give me a double portion of my inheritance, because I'm the firstborn. Now, Elisha was not his natural child, and he wasn't asking for land or wealth. He was asking for spiritual power. And what you see is that in the passing of the mantle, like passing of the staff of Moses, Elijah has given that double portion of his prophetic powers to Elisha. And we see that manifest right out of the gate with two public signs of divine presence and authority. The first sign is he heals the waters of Jericho. Jericho had been rebuilt at the cost of two firstborn children, but he was the water of the city of Jericho was still foul. And so Elisha's first sign is to throw salt into that water and make it clean and pure. The second is there's a group of boys that come from the city of Jericho, and they're mocking Elisha. "Hey, Baldy," teasing him. I know, if you're lacking hair up here, I don't make fun of bald people because mine is going away up here, starting to. But these young guys are teasing him because he was missing some hair. And he calls down God's judgment on them, And two bears come out and kill 42 of these boys. It's fairly serious to mock a prophet of the Lord. Yep.
I struggle with every one of those kinds of incidents, and there have been countless numbers so far where, you know, either an innocent that's simply a descendant of a sinner, or you know, someone who is peripherally involved in sin is condemned in this horrible, deathly way. And I keep struggling with that. But this is what's unique about this one is that it's children.
Right. Yeah, but they were,
they were teasing the prophet, but come on.
They were mocking a prophet. And you know, here's the thing. God is holy, 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 holy. I mean, this is the message that you get that comes across all through the Old Testament. You so much as touch the Ark of the Covenant inappropriately, you will be killed. And we do not, in our modern post-cross, mercy, loving people, mercy, grace, love, we're all into all of that, we are losing a sense of the holy, holy, holiness of God. That holiness is present in the new covenant, hence the cross. That's why the cross is important, is because God is holy. And remember, Jonathan Edwards, he preached a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It's a very famous sermon. But you don't want to be a sinner that falls into the hands of a holy, holy, holy God without the cross. That's the point of his sermon. Cannot mock God. We have gotten too casual in our day and age about things that are holy. But these children would grow up to become adult mockers.
At what age do boys become men? Because if they're 16 years old and they're considered boys, they may have already been etched in there. I mean, it sounds like a gang.
Sure. It's a pack of wild boys. Well, I mean, I think the typical age is 12, 13 is when you became accountable to the commands of God. And this is what the whole concept of the bar mitzvah is. You become a son of the covenant, and you're actually, at that point, responsible for your own sins against the covenant. And that's the whole purpose of the bar mitzvah, is to give that ceremonial moment where a child will read the covenant and, in a sense, testify against himself, but you're testifying against yourself that you understand the covenant. You have studied the Torah, you understand the terms of the covenant, and you are accepting responsibility to be faithful within it. Maybe these boys were ones that had come of age and had taken that commitment on. Look, you know, there's a lot of things in the scriptures that are challenging. I think the message that you should take from this is God is holy and you don't mess with the prophets. You take the prophetic office and you take the prophetic ministry seriously. That's why this is in here. Let me keep going. So this next section, chapter 4, verse through 8, chapters 4 through 8, we see the mighty works of Yahweh through the prophet Elijah. And you have just a series of stories of his ministry that happen. Elijah's ministry in the Lord was renowned. He ministered not only to the people of Israel and Judah, but he ministered to kings and to the lowly. He had a ministry to foreigners and to foreign kings. So the section actually culminates in Elisha prophesying to the future king of Syria with tears. So the first miracle that we read about is the widow's oil, where you have the story of the widow's oil that doesn't run out. She's at the end of her money and resources. This is very similar to the widow at Zarephath, that Elijah helped out a widow who was also at the end of her resources. And it underscores, and we were just talking about the judgment coming through the prophet, but here we have the mercy that comes through the prophet. God cares about the widow and the orphan. And you have this concern being manifest through the prophet's commitment to this poor widow by doing this miraculous action where he encourages her to go and get as many vessels as she can find. And she has this oil jug that just doesn't run out, and she keeps filling up all of these vessels until her son can't find any more vessels to fill up, and the oil stops. And then the prophet says, now you got something to sell, and you have resources now. And so he makes her a rich widow through all of the oil. The next story is the story of the Shunammite woman, and you have a couple of things going on here. First, it starts in a sense with the hospitality that is shown to the prophet. Let's turn to chapter 4, verse 8. One day Elisha went on to Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived. Now, so this is not a poor person, this is a wealthy woman. And she urged the prophet to eat some food. So whenever he passed that way, he would turn in there to eat food. And she said to her husband, behold now, I know this is a holy man of God who is continually passing our way. Let us make a small room on the roof with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can go in there. Now, what is happening here? You have a woman who has recognized that this is a man of God, and she is showing hospitality to the prophet. Remember, this will become a very important concept to Jesus and the disciples. He'd send them out into the countryside, and he says, whoever shows you hospitality, whoever welcomes a prophet, welcomes me. Whoever rejects you, rejects me. You have the principle of that teaching of Jesus in its foundational level here, where now think about the connection. Whoever welcomes you welcomes me, is what Jesus said. So whoever is welcoming the prophet is welcoming Yahweh. Now, of course, that was Jesus' claim, to be Yahweh in the flesh. And that's why he can make that connection one-to-one. It's actually a claim to be divine. Interesting, isn't it? But the prophet is being shown hospitality, and by doing that, you're welcoming and inviting the blessing of Yahweh into your home. And that's precisely what you see happening as a dynamic. The prophet then recognizes that he's being ministered to, so he wants to bless the woman. And this is verse 13. He says to his servant Gehazi, call this Shunammite. And so he calls her, and she stands before him. And say now to her, see, you've taken all this trouble for us. What is to be done for you? Would you have spoken a word on behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? You want me to put in a good word for you? What do you want me to do? Now, he actually will do that later on in the story. But for now, she really, what her deepest desire and deepest need is recognized by the servant. Well, she has no son, and her husband is old. And he says, call her. So when he had called her, she stood in the doorway, and he says to her, at this season, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she has a hard time believing it. She says, no, my Lord, O man of God, don't lie to your servant. But the woman conceived, and she bore a son about that time, the following spring, as Elisha had said to her. So she's blessed. And one way to think about it is because she opened her home, the Lord opened her womb. And she's given this blessing. But then we end up with a crisis because this promised son, and you often have this in the stories of the scriptures where the one who is promised actually looks like he's going to get killed. The first time we really see that is with Isaac and Abraham. But this son gets sick, and this actually becomes an opportunity for Elisha to even glorify Yahweh even grander by raising her son. So you have two lessons to gain from this. And then chapters 4, 38 to 41, you have the death in the pot story. Essentially what this is about is again through Elisha, that Yahweh can take that which is harmful and make it innocuous. Through Elisha, he also restored the waters of Jericho. We already talked about that. He threw salt in. Now he's doing that with a pot of stew, a poison stew of death, and he makes it life-giving. Ultimately, one of the prophets, Ezekiel, would promise that Yahweh would take all of the Dead Sea and turn it to life. Streams of living water would flow into the Dead Sea and it would become a lake of abundance. So this is part of the prophetic ministry, is to take that which has been poisoned by human sin and corruption and the fall and turn it around and make it come to life. You have a feeding of a multitude. It's not 5,000, but it is 100. This will lay the groundwork for some of the stories that we're going to read in the New Testament. But Elisha multiplies barley and heads of grain for a starving group of 100 men. And Jesus would repeat this sign with 5,000. One of the more interesting stories is the story of Naaman the Syrian in chapter 5. This is a great story because Naaman is not an Israelite. It's like the widow of Zarephath wasn't an Israelite either. Jesus would use these two stories to make a point later on. He would say, do you think there weren't any lepers in Israel when Naaman the Syrian was healed? Were there not any widows in Israel when the widow in Zarephath was ministered to? And he would say, you know, what's the point of that? God has a plan and has a care and concern for people outside of the nation of Israel. And he will do works of mercy on Gentiles. And this is part of the larger plan of God. You see that here in the Old Testament. Israel was always called to be a blessing to the nations. And so here Naaman is coming to the nation of Israel to receive mercy. He's got a leprosy skin disease and he's not getting well. And so he is challenged to go to inquire of Yahweh, the God of Israel. And he's told to go to the prophet. He first goes to the king, and the king thinks it's a trap. You know, I can't heal anybody. Did your king put you up to this to start a war? You know, did you send us over here to pick a fight with me? And he's looking for the prophet. He's looking for Elisha. And so he goes out to Elisha, and Elisha doesn't even come out of the house to meet him. He just gives him instructions. Go wash in the River Jordan several times and your skin will be healed. And Naaman at first in his pride writes off the prophet's words. And he says to him, were there not better rivers that I could have washed in my countries? And his servant says to him, now hold on a second. What we're getting is a lesson in humility here and to listen to the lowly. If he had told you to do something that was hard, you would have done it. But because, you know, he just tells you to do something that's fairly easy, you're not going to listen. And the wonderful thing is Naaman humbles himself at the counsel of his servants and goes and washes and is healed. And this is the punchline. Naaman says in chapter 5, verse 15, behold, I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So here he moves from being this prideful place because of his affliction to humbling himself and lowering himself to the point of listening to his servants. And submits himself to the prophet and to the God of Israel. The other lesson here is Elisha's servant, Gehazi, hears Naaman offer Elisha the moon. You know, what can I do for you? I want to pay you for this. And Elisha accepts no compensation for what he has done. But Elisha's servant goes, well, that wasn't good. You should have gotten some money out of this deal. And so he runs after Naaman and catches him on the road. And he asks him, hey, can I have a little piece of silver and a couple of garments from this? We changed our mind. Well, we will take some payment. And when he gets back, Elisha curses him for chasing after this aggrandizing effort of his. And he is given leprosy. So you have an exchange taking place. One who is high lowers himself and is healed. One who is lowly raises himself up and is cursed. Some important things to think about in that story, some good lessons about listening to the Lord and being humble to receive even the craziest of instructions from Yahweh and not being about in it for yourself, but looking to the interest of others. So the last couple of stories, and we're almost done out of time here, you have a very brief little story about the floating axe head. And it's a very similar story to when Jesus' disciples needed some money and he gave them a coin in the mouth of a fish. The prophets were increasing in number and they needed a new house, so they were chopping down wood on the River Jordan, and one of their borrowed axes fell into the river, and he goes, oh no, I had borrowed that. And Elisha takes his stick and throws it into the river, and the axe rises to the surface. You know, it's just kind of an interesting story that's in there, but it tells us that the prophetic band is growing, and Elisha's care and concern for those prophets. You have also the Syrians, and this is that northern threat, comes and they lay siege to the city of Samaria. And you might think that this is the sacking of Samaria, but it actually becomes an occasion for Elisha to defend the city of Samaria. It's not their time to be judged. And the Syrian king grows... Well, you have two stories first. The first is the Syrian king grows impatient with Elisha's inside knowledge of all his movements and tactics, and he goes to war directly against the prophet. The prophet has the armies of the Lord at his disposal, and he reveals this to his servant. He says, open your eyes, and they look out on the fields, and you see all the chariots of fire with the Lord are all out on the fields, and they blind all of the Syrian army and escort them right to the gate of Samaria and then throw a big, huge banquet feast for them and send them back well-fed back to Syria. It's an incredibly interesting story about showing mercy and love to your enemies, actually. And then the Syrians return the favor with a siege and come and lay siege on the city of Samaria. This is some time later. And it results in this tremendous inflation of prices for things that you wouldn't normally eat, such as a donkey's head and dove poop. And the people even resort to cannibalism of their own children. And the king of Samaria, the king of the northern tribes, begins to repent, but it's a false repentance. He's wearing sackcloth and ashes, but don't be fooled. He's ticked off at Yahweh for the judgment, and his solution in his, quote, repentance is to kill the prophet. And so he sends people to go and murder the prophet, and instead the prophet responds again with mercy and prophesies that that great inflation of prices is actually going to come down, and you're going to be able to buy grains at very reduced prices. The captain of the guard of the king says, if the Lord himself should make the windows in heaven, could this thing be? Skeptical. And when the prices come down because the Syrian army flees and everybody rushes out to plunder all the spoils, the captain is trampled underfoot for mocking again the prophet. The final story, and we'll end with this, And I'm on page 151 of the handout. Elisha goes and appoints Hazael to be the king of Syria. Ben-Hadad is dying, and he sends Hazael, his servant, to go and inquire of the prophet Elijah. Elisha goes to Damascus, actually, which is in Syria, and ministers in that region, and he prophesies to Hazael with tears. And Hazael asks, "Why does my Lord weep?" And he answers, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses. You will kill their young men with the sword and dash in pieces their little ones and rip open their pregnant women." Hazael says, "What is your servant who is but a dog that he should do this great thing?" You know, he gets excited hearing this. And Elisha responds, "The Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Syria." And so Hazael goes back and he tells his master, the king, "The prophet said you're going to be restored." And then he murders him the next day and sets himself up to be the king of Syria. We'll pick up there next week.
Thanks for listening. For more information, check out stpeterslakemary.org.